Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce cost and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/strange right now. netsuite.com/strange. netsuite.com/strange. I'm Laura Norton, and this is One Strange Thing, the show where we search the nation's news archives for stories that can't quite be explained. Strangers, if we were in the mood, we could probably release a very long episode about the history of werewolves as they appear in world legend and history. We won't do that because it's kind of the whole point of the show to not produce documentary-length material, but trust us, there is a lot out there. When we think of a werewolf in the popular imagination, we imagine a human that changes form. Definitely under the full moon, and maybe at other times, too. Does a werewolf become a full wolf, or a wolf man, or a wolf person? Are werewolves turned, or are they born? Honestly, it depends on the legend, or the YA book series. Now, we don't claim to be historians. We went to school for the very paranormal subjects of creative writing and public policy. But after some reading, we think that we can fairly say it's hard to pin down precisely where the concept of werewolves, people who turn into wolves but don't stay that way, really began. From Gilgamesh to the Greek legend that gave us the word lycanthropy to the Middle Ages, when it was rumored werewolves hid their hairy coats underneath their skin, to the modern age of silver bullets and Team Jacob, werewolves have taken many forms. The difficulty of giving an overview of werewolves comes down in part to how we define that term in the first place. Are we expanding the concept to encompass skinwalkers? Are we limiting ourselves to written records? Can we stretch the definition to include dogman-style cryptids? And what about people who just believe they're werewolves? People diagnosed with clinical lycanthropy rather than any true supernatural affliction. Really, we could write a dissertation on the subject. Plenty of other people have. Strangers, the point here is that, historically speaking, both legend and fact turn up bits and pieces of what today has become the basic werewolf formula. Add to that the ways in which cinema and literature have shifted our concepts, and it's probably not so surprising that some of the werewolf stories here in the United States, they seem a little, well, muddled up. We've told you a few here on the podcast already. The Beast of Bray Road, for instance, should probably count, though you could as easily argue that monster is a canid cryptid. The same goes for the Michigan Dogman. Does a werewolf have to have a human form to be a proper version? What about vice versa? According to Merriam-Webster, the were bit derives from Old English, meaning man, so man-wolf. But how much of that is literal? And how much license do we take when a good story presents itself? A story that seems, on its face at least, to have roots in fact. We've been thinking about all of this, strangers, because of a very odd tale that landed in our laps. As far as we can tell, it began circulating in the late 1990s, but its subjects lived more than a century before that. They were real people whose births and deaths we can trace in public record, and they resided in a rather rural area of West Central Georgia. And though this tale is not widely known, it's remarkable in a number of ways. A rare American werewolf tale, tied not to a cryptid, but to a person, one with a historical record. And more than that, to a woman who lived through the Civil War and into the early years of the 20th century. Emily Isabella Burt, who's become known as the Georgia Werewolf, lived for nearly 70 years. But only a brief period of her life has caught the interest of supernatural enthusiasts, the allegedly lycanthropic bit, which is to be expected, we suppose. When someone is purported to be a werewolf, that does tend to eclipse their other activities. But actual hard news sources concerning Emily Burt and her werewolf activity are very sparse. Non-existent, actually. Now, there are TikToks and blogs and YouTube videos, but they all seem to circle back to one source, a 1997 book by now-deceased author Nancy Roberts. Roberts was a rather famous writer who collected ghost tales and legends into popular collections. She told the story of Emily Isabella Burt in a collection called Georgia Ghosts. The short tale, it's no more than a few pages, primarily concerns two wealthy families from Talbot County, the Burts and the Gormans. According to historical news and ancestral records, they were both wealthy families and well-respected in the area. The Gormans were enmeshed in local politics, and the Burts were involved in all manner of business. After the death of the patriarch, Joel Burt, in 1847, his wife, Mildred, took over the running of the family's economic concerns. According to ancestry records, the family had seven children before Joel's death. Emily Isabella Burt was their fourth child and came along in 1841. It was her girlhood in the years after her father's death that became the focus of Nancy Roberts, and now the focus of many paranormal enthusiasts across the digital landscape.
Looking for creepy stories? Then we might have a podcast for you.
And now, presenting Rattled and Shook.
Rattled and Shook is a weekly podcast that features new scary stories every episode, kind of like this.
I would hear her say things to me inside my head.
I couldn't get around him. I was trapped.
The other guy started to get pretty agitated. He grabbed my grandfather's oxygen hose and he cut off his oxygen.
Then I started thinking, well, you know, who would be hanging around in this nowhere forest, in this nowhere area? And that's when I started looking more closely. And that's when I noticed there were several shapes. And they were slowly working their way toward me as they were moving from tree to tree.
New episodes of Rattled and Shook are out every Thursday. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm sure you've heard the old adage that you should learn something new every day. It's good advice, but with so much to do, are you making time to learn and stay curious about our world? Well, with Everything Everywhere Daily, you can easily make that goal a reality. Everything Everywhere Daily is one of the world's most popular daily education podcasts. In about 10 minutes, you can learn something new every day. The show covers history, science, geography, mathematics, and technology, as well as biographies from some of the world's most interesting people. One listener says the show truly makes my day more enjoyable and entertaining. Fans of the show are so passionate, they even work to join the Completionist Club, the group of dedicated listeners who've listened to all 900 plus and counting episodes. I highly recommend you check out Everything Everywhere Daily's recent episodes on Why Are There No Flying Cars? And The Little Ice Age That Happened 700 Years Ago. Learn something new every single day with Everything Everywhere Daily. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to be attacked by an alligator? Or what goes through one's mind as they're stranded in a snowstorm? What Was That Like is the podcast for you. Real people come on every episode to explain the unbelievable situations they've been through. Guests share how they really felt during their most surreal experiences. They tell us what they did the morning before an earthquake, how it feels to win The Price is Right, and all sorts of details that you'd never learn anywhere else. If you're interested in hearing disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, What Was That Like is the podcast you've been looking for. Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know that even the most unrealistic are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like wherever you get your podcasts. The excellent Georgia Mysteries blog provides a good summary of the story that has circulated since the late 90s. And like us, the author, Professor Jeffrey Wells, also identifies its primary source as the book Georgia Ghosts. The basics are this. Sarah Burt, older sister to Emily Burt, was engaged to the son of the Gorman family, whose property was near to the Burts. And thus, he was often over at the widow Burt's home. Emily Burt, middle child of the family, was seen as odd by the small community. It was rumored that she had dark hair and bushy eyebrows, and purportedly sharp teeth, which her mother worried about. Mrs. Burt allegedly took her daughter to the dentist over these concerns, but it never amounted to anything. And it was claimed that Emily had a fondness for books about unusual subjects, like ghosts and the paranormal and the like. At some point in her early adolescence, it was said that Emily began suffering from insomnia and that she developed a dependence on opium-based medicine to get any rest at all. But still, she couldn't truly sleep, and rumor spread that she could often be seen out at all times of night, not at all appropriate for a young girl living in the 1850s, as you might imagine. Basically, strangers, the setup is that Emily was a black sheep in an otherwise staid, upper-class family. The major action ensued when the Gorman estate was plagued by animal attacks targeting their livestock. W.R. Gorman would come over and recount those tales to Sarah, his fiancée, and to Mrs. Burt. And Emily, who would listen, seemed fascinated too. A little too fascinated, you might say, by all of the killings. W.R. told the women that the slayings were unusual because they went beyond a predator's need to eat. They were absolute bloodbaths. So it's said that the Gormans decided to gather some men and go looking for this creature, whatever it was, to put an end to this animal slaughter. The version told in Georgia Ghosts claimed that on the night that the hunters went out, Sarah Gorman was awakened by some noise in her room. She saw her mother leaving the house, and she soon realized that Mrs. Burt was on the trail of none other than her sister Emily, who'd gone out into the darkness alone. She was shocked when she saw her sister head out into the Gorman's field and that Emily was, quote, prepared to spring upon a sheep. It should be noted here that nowhere is it described that Emily was in wolf or wolf-human form, but, according to this account, she was carrying a very large knife. In the Georgia Ghost telling, Mrs. Burt screamed at Emily to stop. As for Sarah, she took that opportunity to faint, which was convenient for the plot. When Sarah awoke the next day, she found out that her sister Emily's hand had been blown off the night before by gunshot, and that her mother had been injured as well, but that there was no mention of Emily attacking anything. The story that they told was that Emily had been wandering in the night, as she did, and had accidentally gotten in the way of the hunters at the farm. Then, it was said, the family quietly took Emily to Paris to be treated, quote, by a famous specialist in lycanthropy, a psychological disease in which an emotionally disturbed person manages to convince themselves that they have become a werewolf. Now, According to this tale, the treatment may have worked, because Emily came home and, quote, there were no more problems, at least none that were, quote, proven. But the tale goes that her story spread, and Emily remained hidden among her family. When she eventually passed away, the legend claims, she was buried in the small town. Then, it said, her grave became infamous, and it was known as a haunted spot, where people could hear, quote, moaning and howling in the night. So, pretty spooky, right? And it does set up Emily in an interesting is-she-or-isn't-she role. She doesn't turn into a werewolf, but we get those hints about her sharp teeth, her bushy eyebrows, her odd behavior, her haunted grave, so much that it's hard not to see the likeness to a wolf girl. It's purposely unclear whether we should view Emily's story as fully supernatural or something psychological, that she was experiencing the condition that we've referenced a few times now, clinical lycanthropy. Per the NIH, that condition is, quote, a rare variant of a delusional misidentification syndrome, but it's almost always a piece of a more complex neuropsychiatric condition or physiological illness. And it just wouldn't explain the purposefully wolfy elements built into the front end of the tale. Now, the author of Georgia Ghosts, Nancy Roberts, who several websites call the First Lady of American Folklore, seems to have sought out some real details concerning the families purportedly involved here. She was close to correct in her estimate of when Mildred Burt was widowed, 37 years by Nancy's estimation and 35 according to census records. And she included a great deal of detail in regard to the family's holdings and inheritances. She also correctly identified the fiancé of Emily's older sister Sarah, William Gorman, better known in local papers as W.R. Gorman. He's correctly described in the book as a gentleman farmer. And Sarah did go on to marry W.R. And the names of other important people, they match up too. According to author Denise Roth, who you'll be hearing more about in a moment, the family did travel to Europe, but not to Paris. It appears they were visiting family, not werewolf clinics. Emily did not spend her whole adulthood in Talbot County. In her old age, she resided elsewhere with relatives. Emily died in 1911, and then she was returned to Western Middle Georgia to be buried, but not as close to her hometown as imagined. And that, strangers, does prove historical connection to the apparently fantastic tale. We might even say that it then holds some water. Or it would, except for one strange thing. There's a rather large pile of evidence that disproves just about everything else. There are no citations in the book, which is not altogether unusual, especially in publications from decades ago. But there is also a lot of license taken with the details, like dialogue, which we certainly wouldn't have any idea about. But it goes much further than that. Now, we are not here to cast any aspersions on Miss Roberts' excellent storytelling. She truly is a master. But it feels like that's what it is. A great invention with a few historical details thrown in for just the right flavor. And that in and of itself is a genre of writing that has existed for a long time. The trouble comes when it's taken literally by readers and then accidentally becomes historical fact versus a fictive version of the past, usually through the obfuscation of the internet. It's almost as if this is a very early version of those mid-aughts monster mashup novels, where a historical figure is taken and then thrust into an entirely imagined situation, like Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Because, based on our research and on the work of Denise Roth, author and founder of the Southeastern Institute of Paranormal Research, there is absolutely no evidence of supernatural or clinical lycanthropy in the life of Emily Burt. When we were looking into Emily's case, we managed to actually track down and speak with Denise Roth. We first saw her name mentioned in the Georgia Mysteries blog as someone who had disputed the Emily Burt werewolf story all the way back in 2009. And when we spoke to Denise, we found out why. Denise first heard the story the same way that we did, floating around on the internet. When she visited the private land where Emily Burt is buried and spoke to the landowners, she found out that Emily's grave has regularly been vandalized and disturbed by thrill seekers, something that truly disturbed her. And then she saw a photo floating around that was supposedly of Emily Burt, but that had no historical connection to the woman herself. So, Denise decided to do her own investigation and find out if there was any truth to the story at all. If Emily had ever been associated with either supernatural or clinical lycanthropy during her lifetime. Like us, Denise found absolutely no archival evidence to support any animal attacks or serious injury to Emily Burt in the media of the time. Denise also went to Talbot County to go through their non-digitized records. She was able to look at, and this is pretty amazing, actual logs from the dentist and physician who served local families. There's a dental appointment for the Burt family listed, but nothing of note is recorded. No word on Emily's eyebrows, but let's assume we can rule those out too. There were also no indications of treating Emily Burt for any serious injuries, such as having her hand blown off, or any of the other incidents indicated in the story. Moreover, we could find no evidence of animal attacks on the Gorman property within the appropriate time frame, in any time frame actually, or near Pleasant Hill, the outpost where they lived. And Denise was also able to track down some of the family's and Emily's personal papers. Included in those records was Emily's will. In that time, Emily amassed a fortune that Denise estimates to be worth around $3 million in today's money. Emily also managed multiple businesses and properties until her death. We found Emily's obituary, which was printed in the Talbotton New Era newspaper, and Denise made sure to post it on Ancestry.com, too. It read, "Death of Miss Emmy Burt. Miss Emmy Burt was born and reared in this county midway between Bellevue and Pleasant Hill at the Burt Homestead. For more than half a century, this dear old home was the seat of hospitality and neighborly cheer. A few years ago, she made her home with her widowed sister, Mrs. Mildred Butts. About a year ago, the two sisters removed to Marietta, Georgia, to live with Mrs. Butts' daughter, Mrs. Luther Benson, where Miss Burt died on June 18th after several years of failing health. Everything that devoted love could suggest, her best medical skill could accomplish, was done to prolong the life of this dear one, but all in vain. Death, though inevitable, is always sad, but when it takes from us one who has grown dearer with each passing year of a lifetime, it is doubly distressing. The death of Miss Emmy Burt brings sorrow to many hearts here in Talbot County, where she lived for so many years, and where her name is a synonym of Christian greatness and grace. Her ministering hands have brought comfort and cheer to many sick beds, and her unfailing sympathy and hope to the sorrowing and afflicted. Wherever she went, her noble, unselfish nature was a proverb among her friends. God bless her precious memory, and consecrate it to the eternal good to those who love her, and bring peace to the stricken hearts of her only sister and other near and dear ones who consider her loss irreparable. She was buried by the side of her father and mother in the family cemetery near Woodland, one who loved her." Now, strangers, it's obvious that a family member is not going to say, "And by the way, she was a werewolf," or believed herself to be one. But there are many indications that Emily Burt was directly involved in her community in a public way. She was not the shut-in that stories have indicated. And she was, by this account, well-loved. We could not find any record that, per Georgia Ghost, there were, quote, persistent rumors that she was a werewolf. In fact, we did not find any mentions of any werewolves at all in decades of newspaper clippings, outside of a letter to an editor at the Atlanta Constitution, wherein the writer wanted someone there to explain what a werewolf was. But that was in 1889, long after the supposed events of this story. And honestly, a letter to the paper was the 19th century equivalent of a Google search. There was absolutely no mention of any werewolf activity in Georgia there. And trust us, someone would have delved into that. Now, we should mention that some have made much of the inscription on Emily Burt's grave, which reads, "Thy form alone is all, thank God, that to the grave is given. For we know thy soul, the better part, is safe, yes, safe, in heaven." What they focus on is the word form, as in, maybe she had more than one form. Strangers, we must say that is a stretch, a big one. A more common sense interpretation is straightforwardly religious, that Miss Burt had transcended in the Christian belief system of her family to be with God. Of course, it is very common to base a legend or a fiction on a bit of historical truth. Writers have been doing it for centuries. Today, we reimagine real, notable figures from our own histories as sleuths or spies or even supernatural creatures. In this case, it's likely, though we cannot fully prove it, that something similar happened. We can't get our hands on every single historical paper, of course, and maybe there is some hidden werewolf story just out of reach. We doubt that, though. Denise Roth has done her research, too, in person, and she would prefer that people leave Emily Burt well enough alone. And we imagine that author Nancy Roberts would have been horrified to discover that folks were vandalizing Emily's grave, too. In summary, we feel pretty confident in saying that The Georgia Werewolf is a work of fiction. Exciting fiction. And that Emily Isabella Burt, were she to travel to the 21st century, would be extremely surprised to find herself embroiled in it. Imagine, strangers, what might be done with your legacy in the hands of a few particularly creative writers. You might end up the star of a fan fiction romance, married to a thinly veiled version of Harry Styles. Or you could be cast in the next horror blockbuster. After all, that's the trouble. One can never really know. We hope you'll join us next time for another real-life story from the fine print of America's local papers, from the lives of regular people, just like you and me, except for one strange thing. Special thanks to Denise Roth for her invaluable help with this episode. Please be sure to follow the Southeastern Institute of Paranormal Research. Strangers, I've released my first book. It's available everywhere now as audiobook, hardcover, and ebook. I read the audio version myself. It's called Lay Them to Rest, and it's about John and Jane Doe's, my years-long experience following forensic experts around the country, and our efforts to solve the mystery of a cold case. One Strange Thing is an independently produced podcast. To support the show and to hear more of the entirely true and enticingly peculiar, you now have three options to enjoy two extra bonus episodes a month. On Apple Premium and Supercast, you can get the bonus episodes delivered to your app of choice for just $2.99. And for $2 more a month on Patreon, you'll get more fun extras. There you'll find ad-free early releases of our regular episodes, two full-length bonus episodes, monthly giveaways, blog posts, and occasional live streams, all for $5 a month. We hope you'll check out one of these options and support the show. There's a link in our show notes. And if you enjoy One Strange Thing, please take a moment to leave us a great rating or review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps.